Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome back to New Books in Art. I'm Kirsten Ellsworth, host of the Art Channel, and today we have the pleasure of speaking with April Damon, author of Carita Kent, Art and Soul, the biography, published by Angel City Press, 2015. Welcome to the show, April.
Thank you very much.
It is my pleasure to speak with you this morning about one of my favorite artists, Carita Kent.
Well, I'm glad to know that you're already familiar with her work.
I am, because I've been in love with her work for years, but today we're going to hear from you about why we should be more interested in Carita's work. So may I start by asking you how you became interested in Carita?
Sure. I had written another biography. I'm an art historian here in Los Angeles, and I was looking for an interesting female subject this time. My first book was about my husband's grandfather, Earl Stendahl, a really visionary but not well enough known art dealer from the early art scene of the 20th century in Southern California. And I knew there were so many other interesting personalities in our area who haven't had their due. And as a biographer, I thought, well, it's my job to bring a few of these wonderful people to the attention of a public who should know about them. So my publisher, Angel City Press, and I talked, and I would say almost simultaneously, Patty Calistro, my editor and publisher, and I landed on Sister Carita, who became Carita Kent. You know, I was at UCLA as a college student in the 60s when Carita was starting to get some attention as an art teacher and as an artist, silkscreen maker, at Immaculate Heart College. And I live about a mile away from Immaculate Heart College, even now, all these years later. And I wasn't far from where Carita was living and working as a nun when I was even at UCLA. So we have a bit of a shared history, and I just felt that I felt that I was led to writing about her.
That's a wonderful answer, and in your book, you speak in such a personal way about, you make Carita really come to life, not in a just informative way, but as a person and the environment of Immaculate Heart. Maybe you would speak to us a little bit about Immaculate Heart and the nature of the place and what might have drawn Carita there or how she shaped that community.
Sure, I'd love to. Carita became a nun at age 18. Here in Los Angeles. She grew up in Hollywood, once again, not far from where I live. And her path was kind of chosen for her. She was enthusiastic about the sisterhood. She had an older sister, Ruth, who had already joined the Immaculate Heart community of nuns here in Hollywood. And she had a brother, Mark, who had become a priest. So her parents kind of, hit the jackpot with two of their children, and it was a big family, six children, you know, entering into religious orders. Immaculate Heart College, then, was the place that Carita knew about, and she made her vows and entered the Immaculate Heart Sisterhood right out of high school, L.A. Catholic Girls High School here in town, and began her long 32-year relationship. Not just on the campus, because that's where the convent was, but in the art department. And I can tell you what I learned, not just from my research, but from talking to many of her former students, who are all about my age now, because we were young in the 60s altogether. They tell a story of a teacher who made them truly feel like artists. Because for Carita, any act of creativity, was art. And, you know, I've come to believe that strongly. As a writer, I consider myself an artist. And so what Carita did was she turned on these conservative Catholic girls, all girls school, mind you, at Immaculate Heart, high school and college. She taught in the high school and the college, and she brought in serigraphy, and they got their hands dirty with ink at the silkscreen presses. She brought in famous Los Angeles dignitaries from art world. Don't ask me why they said yes to her invitation. Will you come and speak to my girls about architecture, Buckminster Fuller? Will you come and talk to my girls about film, Alfred Hitchcock, Beatrice Wood, Henry Miller? That was a controversial guest. And people said yes to her because they heard something very interesting was going on at the corner of Franklin and Western in Hollywood, where a young nun was turning inexperienced Catholic girls into art.
What a story. Just the names you mentioned, from Buckminster Fuller to Henry Miller at a Catholic girls' school. It's hard to believe. Do you have, in your research, which is so important for everyone to know, that research is driven by your interviews with many students, people who were, you know, who had the chance to encounter Carita. Do you feel there was a force of personality that Carita had, which made people curious about her? Or do you have any thoughts about how she pulled that off?
That's a really good question. She was captivating in person, quiet but magnetic. That's what I heard over and over again. But she had a kind of a partner in crime over there in the art department, and that was Sister Magdalene Mary, who was the chairman before Carita. And Maggie was almost like Carita's agent. She promoted Carita's artwork when Carita was completely unknown. And I think Maggie also had something to do with making some of those invitation phone calls. And she made sure the Los Angeles Times and the old Herald Examiner, our local papers, knew of some of Carita's latest work and where a couple of the prints had sold. And so between the two of them, and then later pretty much just Carita, they created this kind of aura about what was going on over there. But you asked about Carita's personality specifically. You know, she battled insomnia her whole life. And in my research, I came to believe that she had depression, and there wasn't medication for it. There wasn't even, I think, an accurate diagnosis. She just kind of worked, kept busy, almost in a manic way, and she drove her students to meet those same challenges and the same demands. But whereas I think it took a toll on Carita, what the students saw wasn't the nun who was awake all night, or the nun who was sad and, you know, having trouble establishing an energetic point of view when she was so tired. What they saw in the classroom and in the art workshops was just a dedicated, loving teacher with a smile, so encouraging. It's not like she was putting on an act, not at all, but she knew how to focus where she had to, and then how to go and try to sleep or pray. You know, as a nun, she had just a devout and deep prayer life, along with all of her beloved sisters. And so she had God, and she had the Catholic Church, and she had the camaraderie with very bright, progressive nuns at Immaculate Heart College. So I would say her support system allowed her to keep up the pace that she did.
I'm trying to imagine insomnia, art, teaching, politics. Mm-hmm. She obviously had a lot of energy, although, as you mentioned, depression that possibly was untreated. Many artists, I believe, do suffer from depression, and sometimes the art becomes an outlet. You mentioned the support community. Would you speak a little bit about her relationship with Charles Eames?
Yes. I think I quote in the book that Sister Carita considered Charles Eames her first real teacher. And you know, she had some good teachers, an MFA from USC, and the teachers at Immaculate Heart College when she, as a young nun, earned her Bachelor of Arts degree. And yet it was in taking some workshops and classes from Charles and later Ray Beans, his wife, that she felt she was just enlightened by his philosophy of art and design as something practical, something that you do to enhance your living environment and your world. And so I found I went to Harvard and to Radcliffe College to a couple of wonderful libraries, the Schlesinger Library for the History of Women. Oh, that was a treasure trove. They have a large Parita archive. I spent days looking through correspondence and photos and essays, and what I found there was that Charles Eames was a very great influence for her, and she just admired him personally and brought her students to his important experimental home in Pacific Palisades to see how he and Ray lived what they taught.
I really imagine a student today to hear a group of students went to the home of Charles and Ray Eames and actually got to interact. I think they were doing a lot of their film work at the time. It's just hard to imagine. But as you said, Corita had that special something that let her really interact with the LA crowd and very famous designers. Would you like to add any words about what the Los Angeles art scene was like when Eames was here and maybe moving into the 60s? What was Corita, what did she encounter once she walked out of the convent into the city and interacted with these artists?
Yes, and you know, walking out of the convent into the city with her students was so important to her. The nun's life can be an insulated life. But Corita and her sisters, as I said, they were a progressive bunch. They went to Fellini movies without permission occasionally. They just explored their whole urban landscape. And at the head of the pack was Corita. And so what a vibrant time to be making and teaching art. You know, I wrote a biography of my husband's grandfather, Earl Stendahl, who was very much a part of that scene. Quite early, the 20s, the 30s, all the way into the mid-1960s. So as an art historian, I really studied mid and earlier 20th century American art, and specifically here in L.A. and in Southern California. And Corita took her students to the Ferris Gallery in West Hollywood. She heard there was something about Campbell's soup cans. I mean, what was that? And she got there and was exposed for the first time here on the West Coast to Andy Warhol's serigraphy. And of course, silk screening is just what captivated Corita and what made her reputation and what she was doing artistically the rest of her life. And she saw that you could borrow something from the commercial world, advertising such as Campbell's soup cans, and turn them into colorful, humorous statements of what it means, maybe give slightly a different meaning to very ordinary objects. Ah, but what Sister Corita did that was so different than others like Ed Ruscha and people also influenced by Warhol, Rauschenberg, she found a spiritual element, or she created a spiritual message in so many of her prints. But it really did start with the late 50s and into the early 1960s when Los Angeles was really, gosh, it was a hotbed for young, innovative artists. And she, I think I say this in the book, she wasn't invited to sit on a bar stool at Barney's Beanery in West Hollywood with the cool school of male artists, but she belonged there. And she was equally influential to some of those important men, Ed Keenholz, Walter Hobbs. What an exciting time for her to be making art. But I have to say, she was a female in full habit, you know? And nuns just weren't recognized as doing much serious beyond taking care of our spiritual life.
You paint such a wonderful picture with your words of that scene, and then the photographs in your book, there you see, you know, these famous avant-garde artists here in Los Angeles, and then there's Corita in her nun's habit. It's really, it's compelling. And you mentioned the pop art. I wondered if you might speak about the tomato controversy, which seems to sort of get us into how maybe the church, some in the church, began to view her ideas.
Yes. Corita was a problem for the Los Angeles diocese. With a more understanding cardinal, someone who wasn't James Francis MacIntyre, I really think she and her nuns could have continued on their path of progressive ideas of education. They so embraced the Vatican II liberalization, where prayer times were not as prescribed, face their congregation. They could, you know, there were so many things that the rest of America embraced with Catholic new ideas and new modernization. But in Los Angeles, that really wasn't allowed. And Corita was the biggest problem, Sister Corita, because her artwork was provocative. It was beautiful. It was colorful. Her technical skill really was magnificent. And yet, you know, here she paints a gorgeous large print of a tomato, and she was actually referring to Holy Mary, the Virgin Mary, as a juicy tomato. This just wasn't all right with the Catholic male hierarchy. The essay written, it's a little hard to read because much of Corita's art has text, as you know. She was famous for combining graphic art and lettering and words. The text was written by Sam Eisenstein, who I was so fortunate to interview for the book. He's still with us. He's quite elderly. He lives in Pasadena, and he knew Corita and still teaches at Los Angeles City College. But Sam did the text. Sister Corita did the beautiful red tomato, the idea being that Mother Mary is holy female and woman. She personifies womanhood, not just the mother of Christ. And so this comparison, comparing her in something that you could infer as slightly sexual, it caused a firestorm in her diocese and really set off a years-long conflict with Cardinal MacIntyre that, as you know, ended in Corita and hundreds of her sisters having to leave Immaculate Heart, leaving their order.
That's a sad part of this, of the book, is when you learn that she left, and as you mentioned, Cardinal MacIntyre, the powers that be just didn't get it, for lack of better words. Do you think that we'd really like to hear from you the years after Immaculate Heart, what kind of art did Corita pursue, and her mood maybe when she left? What a shift from that very cloistered community to being on her own, or not on her own, but living as a, I guess, a civilian in Boston.
Yes, and I don't get asked that question too much, and I'm interested in her post-Los Angeles life because she developed further. She went to Boston, and she lived alone for the first time in her life, an independent woman at age 50, had never bought her own clothing, had never written a check, earned a driver's license, and driven a car. She really, you can just almost not imagine the adjustment that this was for her. But the freedom and the independence, after having worked herself way too hard for many years, she was able to enjoy the positives of that move, and it was a very good move for her. Had friends in Boston, and she had many visitors, and came back to Los Angeles to look after and visit her Corita Prince Gallery in North Hollywood, where her wonderful sister Mary handled the business end of things here on the West Coast for Corita. So she didn't disappear from L.A., but she did create a new life. And what I discovered was, and others have seen this, her her paintings, her silkscreens became softer. She began to paint in watercolor. She was doing more flowers. You know, gone was the pop art of the car and the oil can and the tomato can and the tomato and the lemon that actually, you know, told of the bitter and the sweet. Everything was symbolic. He moved into something that was less symbolic, less poppy, less saturated with color, but something that reflected her own soul's transition. She became quieter, and so did her art. But one can't talk about the Boston years without observing that she became ill a few years after her move. And she had multiple tumors, a couple of different kinds of cancer. She had some remission. I believe she lived, maybe you can tell me, I think you've looked over my book more recently than I have, Kirsten, but she, I think she went about 12 years after that first cancer diagnosis. And so she did well, you know, considering her illness.
Yes, and I was so interested in this part of your book because we don't hear much about the post years. And in addition to the sort of change in the art, also I was really interested that she was pursuing non-Western medicines for her cancer. And it just seems very consistent that she was interested in anything and everything, and didn't really feel bound by rules. So my next question for you, this relationship that she might have had, I guess she did have, with Father Medeiros?
Yes.
What would you describe a little bit about that?
Yes. She said openly to some close friends that she would like to have gotten married. You know, a 50-year-old woman is very eligible, especially someone as bright and beautiful and talented as Carita Kent. She did become Carita Kent. And she had deep friendships, usually with priests. A fascinating one was with Father Daniel Berrigan, who just died, I believe, last year. And, oh, they were close. They considered themselves soulmates, and they saw each other a lot, both on the East and West Coasts. He had a strong relationship of friendship with another priest up in Santa Maria, California, who one of his associates was so kind to give me some never-before-published photographs for the book. And what I would say is her beautiful Catholic heart just, she was attracted to priests. I believe that she finally did truly fall in love with Father Humberto Medeiros. He was Portuguese descent, and he was in the Boston diocese near where she lived. She got to know him well, and he was on the path to cardinal, very high up in the hierarchy. And in fact, he did become a cardinal after she passed away in 1986, and then he didn't live much longer. But I have a very good authority from a close friend of hers that this was a man that she loved, and I think she had a hope that he might leave the church, you know, to be able to pursue a relationship with her, but in fact, he did not.
It's just a bittersweet part of the story, really, especially as you convey it in the book, because Carita's free and she has these hopes to have some kind of relationship, but then there's always the art, right? She always is working on her art, even when she was ill.
Yes.
Which is the sign of a real artist. I'm really interested in your comment in the book that if one wants to look at avant-garde pop art, and I think you also mentioned this in our talk right now, Carita Kent is very much under-examined, maybe because she was a woman, because she's... There are all these other big names. What do you think, how do you think Carita should be studied today by art historians, by students of art history? How do you think she needs to be presented?
I just finished a book, a manuscript, last night. I'm in a great mood talking to you today and to your audience. A short biography of Picasso, an artist you might have heard of. And Pablo Picasso had such a fascinating life. It was so much of his time. Of course, he lived into his 90s. He represented many decades of art and his own personal history. Corita lived only to age 67, so she had a very short life. But I do think there is something about artists who are so identified with their output, their oeuvre, you know, that it's hard to separate them. And maybe we should not even try to separate them. Corita saw herself first as a teacher and then as a woman religious when she was in the church, and third as an artist. But I think toward the end of her life, when some of that dropped away, no longer teaching, no longer a nun, she was able to really embrace her identity as an artist. And no, she never stopped working, because that was her gift to the world. My biography came out at a very good time. Beautiful exhibition called Somewhere in Time, which is taken directly from one of her prints, opened a couple of years ago, gosh, now maybe 3 years ago, at Skidmore College in upstate New York. And I went to see it. The same show traveled to several cities and landed in Pasadena at the Pasadena Museum of California Art last year. It was here about 5 or 6 months. So, of course, I went to see it again, because it's always interesting how new curators and different institutions put up a show. But what mattered was the art. It was those, just a room after room of her beautiful prints representing the various, not schools, but the emphases, you know, that she would find in her own art. Her transitions from very religious art, we didn't talk about that yet today, but she did start out for several years with biblical subjects, and then in the 60s moving into the very vibrant and provocative pop prints, and then later shells from the beach and flowers, and back to some portraiture until she died.
You know, that exhibition, really, I also had the privilege, the good fortune of seeing it. I was very surprised to learn, and maybe you can talk to us about that particular transition, that Corita did start with representational religious work. Why do you think what led her to make the switch into her silk screening and her words and image so different from that more traditional religious art?
I have found in studying other artists that these creative people need to move. They just don't get stuck anywhere. I know Picasso felt it was his responsibility to try the next thing, and in fact to pioneer the next big thing. But very few have the kind of influence he had. But when Corita was out in the city of LA with her students, they were at a gas station reading signage. They were in the Market Basket grocery store across the street from the convent looking at the signs and prices of fruits and vegetables. She saw through her artist's eye possibilities. And those possibilities, again, with Eames's influence and Warhol's influence, she saw opportunities to try new things. And she had these young 18, 19-year-olds who were so willing to go along with her and push these boundaries. So it was a perfect storm of innovation and creativity. But her eye, it was so important. She would create a small rectangle that she called a finder, which is about the size of a Kodak slide. We used to use Kodak slides, you know. And that little 2x4-inch rectangle, the girls were asked to hold it up to their eye and see just that much of their world, this piece, and then that piece. And it was a way to zero in on detail and on what was important in the center of a work that could expand out and become something bigger. So she had these ideas that just could not be contained. And so, of course, she went from one genre to another.
It's just you describe that characteristic in artists so well. Have to keep moving forward. What's going on in the world? So important to Greta. What about her? Maybe it's a little underestimated when you see the fantastic silk screens photographed very well in your book. She was really good at silkscreen, is my understanding. I mean, she made some difficult pieces that, as I read in your book, she even had a point where she was questioning if her art was going in the right direction, and she was writing to Anais Nin, another unusual friend.
Yes.
Would you like to comment a little bit about her technique?
You know, she had some doubts along the way. I know, as a writer, I need feedback from time to time from someone talented, a little more objective, much more objective than I am. And so I share my work with people, and so did Greta. Anais Nin, can you imagine? She had correspondence with so many fascinating people, and she respected the opinion of others. She recognized that she was subjective. But I don't remember her ever really doubting her own talent. She began making silk screens in 1955 or so, really early on, while still in graduate school. When I do my PowerPoint talk about from the book, with the beautiful slides from pictures in the book, I talk about that she starts out, as I said to you, with the biblical figures, and then she moves on to something less representational, but always, always wanting reaction from those who are looking at her work. And so when I give my talk, I encourage a little bit of feedback from my audiences. What do you think of this? Do you own any of Carita's art? Would you hang this on your wall? And she became just very talented as a serigrapher, winning awards at Los Angeles County Museum at age about 22.
It's incredible, and I think this is a good spot to remember. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about the formal education in art that she pursued while being a teacher and fulfilling her duties as a religious person.
It wasn't easy, because as a member of the convent, she was teaching. She was sent off to an Indian reservation in Canada for a few years to teach children on the res. And then she comes back and she's assigned to high school students in Immaculate Heart. And now she's earning her BA in art from Immaculate Heart. It took her 7 or 8 years at USC to complete the Master of Fine Arts because she had a big teaching schedule and her prayer life and her responsibilities at the college and at the convent. So she had a lot on her plate. And things, she had goals, but it took a while to reach her goals. But she was so capable. She met every challenge and participated fully in each one.
I'm interested, too, in hearing a little bit more about her adding to the list of things she did, her traveling. She really loved to travel and pulled off some pretty interesting trips.
Well, Catholic nuns were very much respected and honored. I hope they still are out there in our world. And there were free hotel rooms and free meals and a very generous member of our LA Catholic population, someone well known to the nuns and who supported Immaculate Heart College and our local diocese, funded how long were they gone? I think Carita and Sister Maggie were gone about a year and a half to Europe and to North Africa. And so budgets weren't a problem for her during those years. And she was an avid photographer. She took 8,000 slides on that long European tour. She was looking at art. She was looking at architecture. It was just a wonderful eye-opening trip for her. And who benefited? All her students, when she returned, she would show the slides and talk about them and what she had seen. Me, the fascinating part of that trip and trips across the U.S., she collected folk art that she would use as subjects for the girls' projects or in her own painting and silk screening. And by the time that Harita and Maggie were gone for Immaculate Heart, they had acquired and the school had assembled a world-class collection of the finest folk art from all over the world. And unfortunately, it was sold off kind of piecemeal at auction around 1980, when the college was just struggling to stay open. Financial problem. College eventually closed anyway. And although the high school is still there and doing well, and that marvelous collection was distributed, you know, just sold off. But I have talked to some people, interviewed people who have pieces from the collection. They were so wise to go to Sotheby's and bid on some of these things and win them at auction, and they still are very proud to have them in their prize.
I was so intrigued by the story of the Folk Art Museum in your book. I didn't know any about that. The Folk Art Museum at the college that they had.
It was more or less a room in the basement with lots of shelves. You know, they may do with what they have.
It just makes me want to know more about, and I wish I had been a student of Karita, what her classroom was like. Do you have anything you'd like to share with us from your research? And I know it's present in your book about the assignments she gave students.
Yes, well, I mentioned that finder to go out in the neighborhood and try to focus on just a small piece of what your vision was. So that was key. Oh, but she worked them as hard as she worked herself. She would have them carving alphabet blocks out of wood and rubber. You know, rubber stamps, whole alphabets A to Z. And they had to turn it in, you know, tomorrow. Some of the parents were, I don't know that in those days if parents ever called up faculty representatives or principals or mother superiors to complain. I have a hunch they didn't. Because although the girls could hardly go to sleep at night, the homework assignment for Karita was so large, but they saw how happy their daughters were and how excited their daughters were to go out to school the next morning. So I don't think anyone was complaining except maybe once in a while the girls. Karita just made very, very big demands on them. And they had to turn things in quickly. And they had to do multiples of things. Find 1,000 words in Look and Life magazine by tomorrow that have anything to do with color. Any word that has to do with color. And these girls are at home turning the magazine. One little girl, this is a funny story. The X-Acto knives they used to do carving and other art projects, maybe preparing plates for etchings. Sometimes they would cut their little fingers. And so there was a pot in Karita's, one of her workshops downstairs in the basement, where anyone who bled had to put a quarter in the pot. And by the end of the school year, they had enough money for quite a nice party. I thought that was funny.
I think that story is typical of the mood at the school. It typifies the mood, and it also makes the book so a page turner. It's a cliche, this, because it just brings to life. I feel like I'm in the classroom, and when I read that they would have to do 200 drawings at a time, but it seems maybe a final question we could address, if you would like, is the fame of Karita. You mentioned magazines, and of course, those magazines the students were cutting from also featured Karita in the 1960s.
There was some publicity, not a lot. When her name really was appearing in the magazines was when she went to Boston. She needed income of her own for the first time, and so she took some commercial commissions. Westinghouse was a big one. IBM was another. And so there were full-page color ads of Karita Kent art with sayings. You know, she was very big on inspiring quotes from the Beatles or from literary figures, poets, our other artists, musicians, Simon and Garfunkel. And so Westinghouse was so wise to put her art in their magazines. I don't know how effective they were in selling Westinghouse products, but it really did put Karita's name out there front and center in a way that it hadn't been as much. And you know, when I was talking to you about her classroom, she played the Beatles a lot. She had music going in her classroom. I mean, it was very innovative. Other nuns in Catholic schools were not doing something.
I think Karita was, the sense I get from your book and from speaking with you today, she was just cool.
Very good. If you had said, April, we have a 40-minute interview, but what I really want you to do is just wrap it all up with one word, I couldn't do better than you.
What a cool woman, and what a contribution your book is. As a very final question, may I ask you about any your future project? You alluded to it, but would you like to tell us more?
Sure. I'm working now for Applewood Books on a series of what they call small biographies. And these are beautifully made hardcover books, but they're quite little, and they're not very long. I think the idea is just to turn people on, maybe particularly the young adult audience, and give them a short biography so that if they really are captivated, they'll go out and learn more. So I've just finished Picasso. Claude Monet is already published, and Van Gogh is coming, and some others. And I think that the press will move into also sculptors and other kinds of artists. Who knows, maybe there'll be a little Karita that I will certainly offer to do. But I'm enjoying this because it's what I do, art biographies.
Well, I would really look forward to that series. And it was a pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you very much for your time. And for giving us this wonderful book. Again, the book is Karita Kent, Art and Soul, the Biography. Our author is April Damman, and this is published by Angel City Press, 2015. Thank you very much, April.
I enjoyed it a lot. Thank you.